This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
Prices are up, sales are down in the local housing market. But Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors President Danelle Moberly says that might just be seasonality.
Just circumstances in people's lives. May is that end of school year. It's the graduations. People are taking their vacations. So we'll see that happen.
We'll look into home sale trends. Plus, WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh reports on more homeowners turning to solar power. And this week's Politics Roundtable looks at the newly signed $45 billion state capital bill. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Prices are up, but the overall pace of sales is down in the Bloomington Normal housing market. As buyers and sellers close deals during the busy summer real estate season, Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors President Danelle Moberly shares her view of the local housing market.
Year to date through May, we dipped down just a little bit, and overall, we are fairly stable compared to last year. The first few months, we were pretty much right on track, and then this last month, we did dip down slightly. So I foresee last year we did have overall the best market that we've had since 2006.
Well, one thing that did not dip down is prices. Those are actually up 5% for existing homes, which is the bulk of the sales that we see locally. Average price of an existing home sale is now about $172,000. Why do you think prices are rising?
I would say that our existing home prices are rising just because of the supply and demand. Right now, our inventory is low, so that helps with that demand, and people are willing to pay a little bit higher as new homes are coming on the market for them. We are seeing multiple offers in certain situations.
So if I'm buying or selling a home in that average price range, so I don't know, $150,000 to $180,000, somewhere in there, how would kind of the state of the market and the supply and demand issues that you've seen, how would that impact the way I price my home? And then how should that impact the way I put offers in on a home?
So as far as listing a home, obviously consulting your local real estate agent would be the best. They're going to show you what has sold in your particular neighborhood and similar homes that match that criteria. The first-time home buyer, that one about 125 to 200 is one of our hottest price ranges. That is definitely a seller's market right now. And then having your home in the best condition that it can be, your agent will help you with that as well. So you want to make sure your condition is in tip-top shape and that you do price it well.
What about if I'm a buyer? How do you think that should kind of change my behavior in the way that I think about when to put an offer in, how aggressive to be with the offer, that kind of stuff?
Yes, definitely that's important as a buyer. The very first thing is to make sure that you are pre-approved with a lender already. We do get some buyers who are a little hesitant to start checking with lenders because they don't have a home in mind, but it's very important to do that up front so that you have your pre-approval letter in hand, because if you find the house that you want, it may be gone by the time you can get to a lender. So that's one of the most important things. And then, yes, you do need to be aggressive. Your agent, again, will pull comparable homes. They'll show you what things have been selling for and then help you make an educated offer on that home so that you can act quickly and not lose it.
Let's get back into the dip that you talked about at the very beginning. So prices are up, but the overall pace of sales is what you were describing. They're down about 5% for the year through May. So in May, about 238 homes sold, the bulk of those being these existing homes we're talking about.
That number is actually down, 15% from May of 2018, down 25% from May 2017. So what are some reasons we might be seeing things slow down a little bit?
Sometimes in the month of May, we will see a little bit of slowdown. I know last year for sure was an exception. We definitely saw an increase. Our April last year was a little bit lighter than it normally had been, and May was really good. And this year we saw the flip of that. So April was really good, and then May did slow down. A lot of times it has to do with just circumstances in people's lives. May is that end of school year. It's the graduations. People are taking their vacations. So we'll see that happen, usually kind of the seasonality of our business.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Danelle Moberly, president of the Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors. So as you mentioned before, our inventory in the Bloomington Normal area real estate market remains low. Before we discuss why that may be, can you define inventory? It's a term I bet people think that they know, but I don't know if you could just put a finger on it.
What we call inventory is just the number of homes that are actively on the market for buyers to choose from.
And why do you think our inventory is low right now?
Our inventory is low right now because of the supply and demand. So it's not that people aren't listing their homes. They're actually listing their homes, and they're selling very quickly. We haven't seen this. I would say almost at least a year, I would feel like that things have been moving this quickly in certain price ranges again. So it is very important for you to contact a local real estate agent to make sure that, as far as the seller's market, if your house falls in that line. But if your home is priced right and it shows well, it's going to sell usually fairly quickly with our low inventory.
So things are selling quickly. Is that mostly in this the price range you described before, the first time homebuyer range, or is it a different range that is moving best?
Mainly in that price range, yes, for sure. And then we're also seeing there's a small pool in the higher end inventory where we have a very lack of inventory in that price range. So around that 450 price range, we have very, very low inventory. And so if you have either a local buyer or a transferee that's coming in town looking in that price range, you don't have a lot to choose from. So those tend, as they're coming on, to sell.
What kind of average days on market are we seeing locally? The amount of time it takes to sell a home? I put up a home for $165,000. What should I expect for how long it'll take to sell?
In the $165,000 range, as far as the May numbers were concerned, they're running just under 60 days on the market.
And how does that compare to recent history?
Overall, our market is going right around 79, 80 days on market. So that price range is just a little bit under what our average is.
There are lots of things obviously happening in the local business community and in any given time. In the last couple of years, it's been changes at State Farm that have sort of dominated or thinking about people moving, coming, going, retiring, yada, yada. More recently, Brandt Industries is a new manufacturer in Hudson, just outside of Hudson, that is bringing in manufacturing jobs. Rivian is another company that is starting to hire a little bit in the next year or so. Should have a few hundred here, I think. Are we seeing anything from the kind of the local business community, anything changing there that you think is playing into local home buying trends in a meaningful way?
I would agree with you that the businesses that are opening, they are definitely going to be bringing jobs to our community, which is a great thing for us, not only for housing market, but just in economics in general. And then, of course, the big one, like you said, is State Farm. They are still our biggest employer, and they are still moving some people out, but they also are still moving people in. And that's one of the things I don't believe that people in the community realize, that they are still bringing new kind of transferees into our area as well.
Well, so you're seeing people coming in from out of town looking for a house?
Yes.
At State Farm?
Yes.
Last week, WGLT, we reported that wages in McLean County, so your average weekly paycheck, here in our neck of the woods, is not rising as fast as wages are rising statewide or even across the country. So what have you and other realtors kind of observed when it comes to, first-time home buyers, their financial ability to make that first purchase? Is there a lot of hesitance at this point or not so much? What are you kind of hearing from people?
The first-time home buyer price range, those are our hottest ones right now. We are seeing a little bit the mortgage rates had kind of flattened out a little bit. And over the last few years, we've always been told, interest rates are going to be going up. You need to be more urgent to buy. And this past year, at the end of the year, we were told that interest rates may actually start coming down, which is a huge thing for affordability for not only first-time homebuyers, but anyone, honestly. And I did talk to Melissa Wellborn from Busey this morning just to kind of get her feel on interest rates. And about the last 30 days, they have been right at 4% and even dipping below 4%, which has made a huge impact for buyers and a little bit more affordability for them. And you can essentially go up maybe another $20,000 with the interest rate dip and get a little more house for your money.
Wow. So it's interesting that rates are still making that big of a difference, because rates have been low and they're currently pretty low. If you've been around for 10, 20 years, you remember what interest rates used to be in the 80s. So even at that level, a slight tick down can make that big of a difference?
Yes. You're looking, she even said that she has people who have closed in January and February, and they're able to refinance today for a percent less, which, I mean, depending on what price range you're at, can save you quite a bit of money per month.
The market for newly built homes continues to be pretty soft. Only, 14 new homes have sold so far this year. That's down about two-thirds from a year ago. Just one new home sale in May. In some comments you made in your last data release, you've said that it's partially a result of better values in existing homes. Can you explain that and how that works?
Yeah, new construction, obviously pricing does continue to go up. I mean, labor prices are going up, material prices are going up, so you can't build the same home that you can buy existing-wise. You can't build it for the same amount of money. So there are people who will decide to buy that existing home because they can just get more value for their money instead. And again, with some transferees going out and some people just making that move up, those homes may not be that old. So they're getting a like-new home for less money than they could actually build. The other thing, too, is that there some builders are definitely still building new construction, but they're pre-sold homes, meaning that a buyer has contracted with that builder to build a specific house for them. What we're not seeing is the spec homes, where they're just building to build the home and then having a buyer come in.
It's Danelle Moberly, president of the Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors. I'm Ryan Denham.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State's nearly 69% graduation rate is 23% above the national average. Illinois State's retention rate also remains among the highest in the nation at 80%. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The first wave of solar hit Bloomington Normal with the advent of a new group purchasing program in 2016. The trend doesn't show signs of stopping as more homeowners go solar through this year's Grow Solar Bloomington Normal group buy. GLT News correspondent Brianna Groh reports the number of homes with solar could soon top 100 in Twin Cities.
Chris Kaufman and Mark Austell stand outside their 1920s-era bungalow in Bloomington's Founders Grove neighborhood, peering out from their wide-brimmed hats at the men working on their roof. At 10 a.m. on this summer day, the sun is already beating down, pushing temperatures past 80 degrees and drenching the solar installation crew in sweat. By the end of the day, Kaufman and Austell will be able to use the 30 360-watt solar panels to harness that power to turn on the lights, cook meals, and send gusts of cooling air throughout their home. Kaufman and Austell are some of the first homeowners to have their system installed in the latest round of a local solar group buy program. This summer marks the third year the Ecology Action Center and the Midwest Renewable Energy Association have partnered to offer discounted rates through volume purchasing at residential, commercial, and agricultural sites in McLean County. Austell says the couple have been interested in solar power for some time, but didn't think they could afford it.
For me, I wanted to reduce our carbon footprint, and stop contributing to global warming. We've done that with our cars. We've had a Prius hybrid and an electric Bolt, so that we don't, use as much fuel. You also wanted to see if we could reduce our energy cost. So I've been personally doing some research on it online for years.
Kaufman says things changed after they visited a home in Congerville outfitted with a solar array.
The homeowner was very generous in letting us walk through the whole house and see it. And it was a very complicated house with many different roof layers. I'm sure it was a challenge for the installers.
it was good to see how well they could work an installation in where our roof is basically flat with one small bump, that it's easier for them to work on.
From there, Kaufman and Austell sat down with Straight Up Solar project developer Kai Ajayi to discuss the potential cost and benefit of adding solar to their home. The Bloomington office of the St. Louis-based company is the program's choice installer. Ajayi told them an array on their south-facing roof could offset 88% of their energy use. Austell says while they saved up some money for the initial purchase,
we also learned about the different credits that were still available to us that reduced the outlay significantly, so then it made it doable.
Ajayi says while there can be a significant cost to purchase the system, homeowners will see a return on their investment over the 25 to 30 year average lifespan of the panels.
Most homeowners are seeing between a 7 and 12 year payback after taxes on their investment in the systems. One just has to realize that yes, there is an initial capital outlay, but by the time you monetize your FITC and you get the solar renewable energy credits, you're looking at anywhere between half and two-thirds of the cost being offset by those credits. So it's definitely long-term. It's a good investment.
Chris Kaufman says she and her husband want to be spokesmodels for solar in Bloomington Normal.
We all use too much power, that's for darn sure, in our little first world world. But if we can do anything, this is a very small thing that we can do.
She's even brushed up on some of the science, ready to share her new understanding of electricity with anyone curious about solar.
The power that hits the modules on the roof is direct current. And what the inverter in the basement does is turn that into alternating current so that it's usable. That is, that it's Edison on the roof and Tesla in the basement.
Ajayi says Straight Up Solar has installed 750 kilowatts of solar arrays since 2016, or about 75 homes.
Which means less coal is being burned, hopefully. So 75 homes in 3 years, and hopefully we'll get another 25 to 30 this time around.
And there's virtually no limit to how much solar Bloomington Normal could support.
Every home in Bloomington Normal has the potential to go solar. Some have better production capacity factors than others. Some are just way too shaded. If you go to older parts of Bloomington, Clinton Avenue, for example, with all the trees they have there, you're not really likely to see very productive solar systems. But in many of the new developments on the outskirts of Bloomington, there's a lot of potential. The utilities may have some limiting factors on the capacity that they can receive from distributed generation sites like what we're sitting in right now. But realistically, the sky's the limit.
Ajayi explains there are outside factors that could make it more expensive for homeowners to purchase solar in the future.
We had some information in the last couple of weeks that have indicated the prices of certain components are going up by 8 to 10% as a direct result of the tariffs that have been imposed by this administration on some of the vital components that go into solar systems. We are hopeful that the tariff situation will be will come to a halt soon, that both parties will come to their senses. But we try to minimize the costs to our consumers.
Ajayi says for now, the company hasn't seen a significant impact on its pricing.
But if things continue the way they're going or they get worse, then we may see some price increases.
Ajayi says the amount of federal tax incentives available to homeowners is set to drop by 4% for the next 2 years, beginning December 31st, adding a sense of urgency for those seriously interested in going solar to take advantage of the maximum credits while they still can. I'm Brianna Groh.
The Ecology Action Center and Midwest Renewable Energy Association are offering Solar Power Hour information sessions at various locations in Bloomington Normal through mid-September. Find those locations and dates at growsolar.org. This is Sound Ideas. Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed gambling expansion legislation and the state capitol bill. Unpacking that today is the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Sean Crawford moderates the discussion with panelists Charlie Wheeler, University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR reporters Sam Dunklaw and Daisy Contreras. Contreras says the $45 billion capital program is called Rebuild Illinois.
It's going to be the first one in 10 years. There's a lot of money involved in this for a lot of things, for vertical and horizontal, vertical construction and horizontal roads and bridges. And over the next 6 years, we're going to be able to see how this money is being allocated to the whole state. And, you know, there's just so much in this bill. Over $14 billion for new roads and bridges, $10.4 billion for state roads and bridges, $3.9 billion for local governments to rebuild their roads and bridges. So, like, there's just, like, many different levels where all this money is going to go to. And Governor Pritzker also signed a gambling expansion bill, which also includes the legalization of sports betting. Now, why are these all bundled up together? Well, because the gambling bill is basically the revenue for the vertical construction plan. So all that money, the taxes coming from the gambling plan will go to maintaining state-owned buildings like prisons and universities, which have been crumbling over the last, for many, many years now.
You mentioned the gambling money that's going to help pay for part of this. Also, gas taxes are going to go up, actually about double the gas tax. Cigarettes are going to cost more. Parking garage taxes also going to come up. Your registration for your license plates, those are going up pretty big as well, percentage-wise. Both Republicans and Democrats, though, were on board with this idea and seems to be pretty much a bipartisan approach to this.
Yeah, and because, you know, these are things that many communities have wanted for decades now. It didn't matter if you were a Republican or a Democrat, your community needed a lot of help with roads and bridges. So if lawmakers wanted to go back to their districts at the end of session and get a good word in that, you know, they did something for the community, they had to vote for this, even if they didn't want gambling expansion. They needed to say yes to that in order to get the money for their transportation needs.
And Charlie, I should mention that when I mentioned it's bipartisan, quite often these are bipartisan because both parties, as Daisy mentioned, want to take something home to the district.
Yeah, and the naysayers in the Republican Party, I noticed none of them got up on the floor and said, we don't want any of the projects. They voted against it because they said taxes are too high and we should pay for this some other way, but they'll be happy to take the projects. Historically, it's been a bipartisan operation because members in both political parties in both chambers realize that you have to maintain the state's transportation infrastructure and its economic infrastructure, for example, universities, if you want the economy in Illinois to flourish. And so that's why manufacturing groups, business groups supported the notion of let's raise taxes to fix our roads. Daisy alluded to the fact that the last time we did this was 10 years ago. The time before that we did that was 10 years before. And if I'm not mistaken, it was like 10 years before that. This new law includes a provision that the gasoline tax will be indexed and increase in proportion to inflation so that each year there'll be additional dollars coming in. One of the problems we face is that we had a gas tax that was at 19 cents for, gosh, I think almost 30 years, and the cost of everything goes up. The cost of labor, the cost of asphalt, the cost of equipment. And when you have a static gasoline tax and with more fuel-efficient cars, you're selling fewer gallons of gasoline. And when you have the costs increasing, you're just always going to be behind the eight ball.
Well, let me ask this, though. You mentioned the taxes and the naysayers out there, but they may have a point in the sense that some of these taxes are what we would term regressive taxes. The people who make the less amount of money still have to pay a pretty good chunk on these car registrations, gas taxes.
Oh, yeah, but the people who use the roads tend to be people from all economic strata. Now, somebody might say, oh, I don't even have a car, so why should I have to pay anything? Think about when you go to the grocery store and you get a gallon of milk. Where do you think that milk came from? Do you think the cow is out in the back lot of the grocery store? All that stuff gets transported, and a lot of it is done by trucking. And if the roads are bad, that impedes the business growth. It impedes the economic health of the state. So this is a very important thing that needs to be done. And as I say, I think in my mind, one of the nice things about it is that we have this automatic increase
And so you won't have to, every 10 years, struggle to get people to understand that if you want good roads, you're going to have to pay for them. Also, we passed a constitutional amendment a couple years ago that says money from the gasoline tax can't be used for anything else. You can't use it to pay nursing home costs, for example, or pay school teachers. It's got to go to transportation-related expenses. I think that also makes it easier for people to accept an increase in the gasoline tax and license plate fees because they know they're not going to be diverted to something other than what they're intended for.
Daisy, this had to be near the top, I would think, for Governor Pritzker as far as his agenda was concerned. He had some other things and other things we've already seen get approved even earlier than this, but this was probably the one that he knew was going to have maybe the biggest impact across the state.
Yeah, I think that he realized that there, you know, for the many, many years now, for example, with the gambling expansion, lawmakers have been pushing to get this through, failed multiple times to get new casinos or expand gaming machines at different places. So, yes, this is definitely going to have an impact, especially also with sports betting. I spoke to Senator Terry Link, who was behind the gaming plan in the Senate, and he said, yeah, I mean, the plan is to have sports betting up and running by the time we're in football season later this year. So we'll see if that happens. We'll see, you know, if the money promised comes through. And I think there are still a lot of moving parts to see if the promises are actually will actually come to fruition.
So you have sports betting, you have more casinos coming in as well. And then this, I felt as though as this went along, these negotiations on gambling, that it was sort of trying to keep up with Indiana a bit, or maybe Indiana was trying to keep up with Illinois, both states doing some expansions this past spring.
Yeah, Indiana and Iowa just recently also legalized sports betting. A couple of other states, I think, you know, every week we see new states at the end of their sessions legalizing sports betting. So right now I think we're up to 16 different localities around the country that have jumped on this. I think 9 different states already are up and running other than Nevada. So, yeah, I think sports betting in particular is expanding rapidly over the last year.
Yeah, and if I may, one of the interesting fights behind the scene that were going on were between sports betting companies like FanDuel and the Rivers Casino folks. Rivers Casino is a casino organization up in the Chicago area. The state has effectively blocked companies like FanDuel from setting up initially in Illinois for a small period of time so that they can have a competitive advantage. So exactly where and how the state is going to implement sports betting infrastructure, I think, remains to be seen.
Yeah, and I think that's up to the gaming board who is going to oversee how sports betting gets to be done. There's going to be a process just like with recreational marijuana to see how that plays out. They are going to be the ones setting up the rules. We will wait and see how those rules are outlined.
And Charlie, before we move off too much on this, the infrastructure program, certainly if you look close enough in there, there's some possibly questionable spending, some earmarks, people might want to call them, or pork projects that were given to help obtain some votes. That's always done in these types of packages. Does that overshadow? I mean, there was things like dog parks in some areas people are complaining about, that money going to those types of projects. But overall, does that overshadow this in any way?
Well, I suppose people who are purists will look at it and say, oh, this is horrible. We have all this pork in there. But years ago, I came to the, what would you say, kind of the conclusion that pork is something in my district is an important public improvement. So a lot of it is in the eyes of the beholder. And if you are going to ask lawmakers to vote for something that might be difficult, it seems to me reasonable to say, what would you like back in your district? What is most important in your district? The criticism comes that when you do it on a district-by-district basis, maybe a dog park is the most important thing in my district, but maybe there's a bridge, Sean, in your district that needs to get taken care of that won't be because I get my dog park. So that's the argument, that we should look at this stuff as a state as a whole rather than as individual pork projects.
That's Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield. Joining him on the Illinois Politics Roundtable was IPR's Sam Dunklow, Daisy Contreras, and moderator Sean Crawford. Governor Pritzker is taking a victory lap of sorts this week around the state, touting infrastructure improvements included in that capital bill and some of the things in the gambling package. This is Sound Ideas.
On on an encore edition of The World Cafe, Talia talks to Andrew Bird, whose latest album is My Finest Work Yet.
Why be coy? Like, this may very well be my finest work yet.
Talia talks to Andrew about drawing inspiration from history, recording his whole album in a room live with the band, and yes, whistling. Andrew Bird on the next World Cafe.
Hey, I'm Talia Schlanger. Join me tonight, 7 to 9 on GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In 2016, a woman who we'll call Linda Johnson was raped by someone she knew. The man did not deny being there or that they had sex. Instead, he claimed the sex was consensual. She said it was not. Ultimately, he pleaded guilty, but it took almost 3 years for Johnson to get justice. Most of that time was spent waiting on DNA evidence to be tested, even though that evidence wasn't even necessary for her case. IPR's Patrick Smith takes the story from here.
Linda Johnson did not want to talk about her experience, but she agreed to let the court advocate who helped her through the legal process share the rough outline of her case, provided her identity was not revealed. Johnson's advocate, Mallory Littlejohn, says the DNA evidence was collected almost immediately after the assault, but it sat untested in state police custody for more than 2 years.
Nobody is going to do anything if DNA is pending, and so there aren't going to be any trials, there aren't going to be any plea deals, the case is just going to sit stagnant.
And so they waited. The hardest part of that long wait, Littlejohn says, was that the DNA wasn't even relevant to the case.
It almost defies logic because everybody in the room, the perpetrator, the cops, the state's attorneys, my clients, myself, we all know who the sex occurred with, and so the DNA is not going to help us.
Littlejohn is the managing attorney at the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. She says Johnson's case is typical of the cases she sees. Most sexual assaults are committed by someone known to the victim. Usually, their defense is consent.
DNA is never going to show whether or not the sex was consensual.
And yet, the cases drag on for years, with prosecutors waiting for irrelevant test results. And it has a big impact beyond individual survivors of sexual assault. There are more than 6,000 cases with untested DNA evidence in state police custody. Nearly 1,000 cases have been sitting untested for more than a year. Every time a case like Johnson's gets added, the backlog grows. The turnaround time gets longer. Brendan Kelly is the acting head of the Illinois State Police. It's his job to try and fix the DNA backlog.
Certainly there are issues within the laboratory system, and we're getting at that. But outside the lab, in the investigative process, in the court process, there are delays, but frankly are artificial.
Kelly says police and prosecutors need to be more selective with what they're submitting for testing in the first place. Before he took over the state police, Kelly was the top prosecutor in East St. Louis.
And I will tell you, from my time as a prosecutor, sometimes we are guilty of just saying, test everything, and then we'll see what happens.
Kelly says that approach might make sense when you're looking at an individual case, but it doesn't work with the realities of the justice system in Illinois.
Everybody wants to jump to the front of the line and have their case tested first, but we're going to have to develop a better management and a better way of triaging what those important things are.
The most recent report from the State Police Crime Lab shows almost 3,000 sexual assault and abuse cases awaiting DNA testing. Based on national statistics, in the vast majority of those cases, the question would not be whether sex happened or who was involved. The issue would be consent. Littlejohn says that means a lot of those cases are overburdening the crime lab for no good reason.
And it is not only the victim client that suffers, it's also the defendant that suffers. And other non-sex cases suffer when our criminal justice system is clogged up.
The Cook County State's attorney declined to be interviewed for this story. But in a statement, a spokeswoman says they cannot make decisions on whether to work up DNA evidence based on what they believe a potential defense might be. I've heard from defense attorneys who say they understand prosecutors' position, but Littlejohn says it doesn't make sense.
From my point of view, I don't see the logic.
Littlejohn says in many cases she's handled, police have videotaped statements with defendants admitting they had sex and claiming it was consensual, or text messages, or other evidence. And they have the testimony from the victim.
The law in Illinois is pretty clear that credible victim testimony is enough to secure a conviction.
In lots of other types of cases, prosecutors go to trial without DNA evidence. But with sexual assault, Littlejohn says, it's seen as an essential part of every case.
It's society. society is the one who kind of buys into this monster myth that it's a stranger that jumps out. And that's when you need the DNA test to link the stranger to the sexual assault.
That means juries expect it, which means prosecutors don't feel comfortable going forward without it. It's a problem rooted in biases and unreasonable expectations. But Little John says considering the long delays and the impact it has on survivors, defendants, and the entire court system, police and prosecutors need to come up with solutions. They can't keep waiting for the state police to just test more and more DNA. Instead, they need to start making tough choices and go forward without it when they can. I'm Patrick Smith.
Listen tomorrow during Sound Ideas for another Patrick Smith report on DNA testing. When is a technological advancement not your friend? When it's so easy to collect evidence, there's too much evidence to analyze. This is Sound Ideas. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is supporting legislation that would roll back one of the provisions of the 1994 crime bill. It's called the Restoring Education and Learning Act, or REAL Act. The bill would restore Pell Grant eligibility to people incarcerated in state and federal prisons. That means people in prison could get federal money to pay for college classes. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines asks the second highest ranking Democrat in the Senate why he supports this legislation.
Well, because we've learned the truth of the situation. Most of the men and women who are incarcerated will ultimately be released. And when they are released, there's an obvious question. Are they going to commit another crime, create another victim, or do something with their lives? We have to start, we should start, in the incarceration period, assessing these prisoners and their future. And I joined in this legislation in the hopes that we can encourage training and education. We have found time and again that when people pick up a skill, become better educated in prison, they have a better chance to come out, not commit a crime, and have a good, positive life from that point forward.
You actually supported the 1994 crime bill, which, among other things, barred people in prison from receiving Pell Grants. Why was that?
It was probably the worst vote I ever cast. I'll bet you've never heard a senator say that. But it was a natural human reaction. We were facing this crack cocaine epidemic, and we were seeing real evidence that it was going to destroy certain parts of our society, and we overreacted. We came down hard, like a ton of bricks, and it failed. That war on drugs failed. Part of it was this terrible dilemma we faced. And they said, okay, you want to give Pell Grants to people in prison, then take them away from the kids who didn't go to prison. Well, that's a false choice. And it turns out that many of us voted to take the Pell Grants away from prisoners and look back on it and said, we're going to pay for that ultimately if people go back into prison after they've served their first term. So we've got to be more proactive and rehabilitative, and we've come around finally, both Democrats and Republicans, to believe that we've got to take a much different approach.
If Pell Grants are reinstated for people in prison, who should qualify to receive them?
That's a good question. I mean, you look at it today, and basically, if you're admitted to an institution of higher learning and you have certain economic circumstances, lower middle-income families, you're eligible for the $6,000 Pell Grant. So we need to think this through. If, for example, those who are serving time in prison would be admitted to a community college program that's being administered in that prison, then certainly compensating the community college and the professor teaching the course is a reasonable way to approach this. Let's do it thoughtfully, eyes wide open.
So are we talking all incarcerated people or just those with nonviolent convictions?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm open to an approach, certainly, for those with nonviolent crimes. But let's be honest, people who have committed violent crimes, many of them, the vast majority of them, are ultimately going to be released at some point. And when it comes down to it, there are certain things we might be able to do in that prison environment that really turns their lives around.
I'm curious how you get something like this passed in today's political climate.
Well, the good news is, kind of surprising news is, the bill I had for prison reform and criminal sentencing reform was actually signed by President Trump on December 22nd. When we put together a coalition, very conservative Republicans, Chuck Grassley, Mike Lee, and then I had my friend Cory Booker, a candidate for president, senator from New Jersey, and we teamed up, of all things, with Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, whose father spent time in prison. So there's a growing bipartisan sentiment to look at incarceration and reducing crime in a different way.
That was Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines speaking with Illinois Senator Dick Durbin about his support for legislation that would restore Pell Grant eligibility to people in prison. This is Sound Ideas. There's a big difference between how a utility contractor prunes trees and how a landscaper might approach trimming a tree. It's understandable when you hear that the goals of a utility contractor are a little bit different than the other arborist. And in this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells WGLT's Mike McCurdy how electrical utilities have to approach tree pruning.
Much of what we think of as nature is actually managed, and some of that is controlled by utilities who have to maintain safe, reliable service. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. And Murph, no one seems happy when trees are pruned by utility contractors, and no one is happy when the power goes out because a branch fell on a tree or a branch or a tree fell on power lines. Seems like a no-win situation.
It is. It's a thankless, and also the people that do the work, it's very dangerous. It's as dangerous as being a rifleman in Afghanistan, and that is dangerous.
So you have some experience in this area?
I worked for Exelon Energy for nearly 4 years and was a senior project manager and a utility forester for them, and I managed this activity over 10,000 miles of lines. And I can tell you that it was an education and one of the most unique jobs I've had in my career.
How so? Just give me an example.
The responsibility, the hazards that are there are numerous and they're real. I saw people get seriously hurt. I've seen fatalities in that line of work. And it's not to be taken for granted. And that's the part that's interesting, because I think everyone, when they turn the switch on and the lights come on, you take it for granted. But there are lots of people behind the scenes that are making sure that that always happens.
How do contractors determine where they need to prune? How do they know where they're going?
Throughout the country, most of the activities of power companies are managed by the government. In Illinois, it's the Illinois Commerce Commission. They set forth the scheduling for the trimming on all of the circuits, and it's kind of a shotgun scatter throughout the zip codes and neighborhoods that make up our state. And it's that way in other communities. There are exceptions in the southeast and along the eastern seaboards where they'll just trim whole neighborhoods at once instead of just particular circuits, which is the typical approach. My understanding was originally crafted to prevent discrimination so that there was no trimming all the rich people neighborhoods and being remiss in other neighborhoods, for example. That is avoided by having the scatter.
These contractors, it doesn't seem like they're trimming for aesthetics. It looks more severe to my eye than you would see maybe a landscaper you might contract with to do your own trees. What's going on here?
There is a whole underappreciated and misunderstood level of arboriculture, and that's utility arboriculture. The trees that are trimmed in a manner that is in hope that they will survive. Some trees are cut down, but they're cut down when there is an opportunity or an imminent hazard. Otherwise, you know, the power company didn't plant any of the trees that they have to keep off of the equipment. And the conflict comes in when a tree that was planted when somebody got married, it now 25 years later, man, this thing is really, it's touching the branches and it's causing the lights to flicker in the neighborhood, and it can even start fires. The trees that come in contact with the wires, particular kinds of trees like cypress, for example, they can just combust and become like this big flame stick right there, and then catch houses on fire. Simply put, the trimming is a combination of a judgment on the voltage. So the higher the voltage, the higher the hazard, and then the type of tree. So if it's a soft, flexible, fast-growing tree like a willow or a silver maple, it's going to get a lot more pruning than an oak or a ginkgo, which are rigid, slower-growing trees.
So what are the rules or the guidelines for going in and trimming these trees?
The scheduling, which is announced usually in the newspaper, you get a thing, a postcard in the mail, and then the city officials or township people. They get notified by our power company. It starts on a four-year rotation for each circuit to receive routine maintenance. And then in cases where there are neighborhoods or circuits that have had problems, they would maybe bump that maintenance up 2 years and trim it again 2 years instead of waiting 4 years. And then before all of that stuff takes place, the emergencies have to be addressed. So every day they go out to do routine work, but they know when they get to work there's probably an emergency overnight that they got to take care of that first.
Is the interaction between trees and power lines the leading reason we lose power?
I don't believe it's the leading reason, but it's one of the biggest ones, because heat and weather can have a big impact on it. Just wind, freezing, extreme heat can cause equipment to fail.
I suppose homeowners ought to just come to grips with the fact that the trees that are adjacent to their property, but not necessarily on their property, aren't theirs, and that they're going to get trimmed if they're in the, if there's power lines nearby.
Yeah, it's not theirs in the easement sense of the easement context, if you will. So a lot of people live on property where there are naturally occurring trees growing, and there's a aerial circuit going through there that provides power for a little farm community or something like that 12 miles away. Those trees, when they come in conflict, they can be trimmed severely, but the people that manage the trimming, there's usually requirements in the companies that they have some level of expertise, including being a utility arborist or a general standards arborist, so that there's some management of the manner in which the trees are cut. And even after trees are trimmed by the power company, a third party comes in and inspects the work, one, to make sure the clearance has been met, but also to make sure that the cuts and the work are proper and that they will hopefully lead to the tree surviving.
And if a tree has to be cut down or it eventually dies because of it's been pruned, the power company's not going to replace that tree.
No.
That tree's in the way.
Yeah, they're not in the tree business. They're just trying to maintain their lines, and they're kind of stuck in the middle, I always felt, because it's the law.
What do you want to say about safety standards and the American National Standards Institute?
That is a wonderful organization. They basically have the specifications and standards on lots of hazardous things. And just doing tree work, aerial tree work in general, whether there are power lines there or not, is dangerous work. And they have something to say about that when it comes to best practices, safety protocols, making good judgments on how to approach the work. They have written the standard for that.
Why not just bury the power lines?
Burying the power lines has negative outcomes to trees also, because that's where all the roots are, and that's less forgiving below ground than it is above ground. And then another reason is when there's a failure in the equipment that's below ground, a lot of times it takes a lot more time and money to restore the outage that's created below ground. So below ground circuits are planned ahead of time when they're going to, say, cut in a new Eagle Ridge or whatever subdivision in an area where there are no trees. So they'll put everything underground when they build all the new houses. Then it's a great idea. But if it's in a spot where there's a whole bunch of trees and then that somebody's had the bright idea, well, why don't you just put them all underground? Okay, we're just going to ram that line right through all the root structures that are down there. For oaks, beech, and hickory in particular, that's bad because that's how some of the diseases that kill those trees are spread.
Who keeps planting these trees in the right-of-way? Are they volunteers or are they people...
Both.
Well-meaning people that just want to plant a tree.
Both. I mean, right here in central Illinois, you and I have talked about, you know, some of the main thoroughfares. They recently planted trees there, and these are areas that need trees. You know, there's like truck stops and restaurants and gas stations. Oh, my. And it's just brutal there. And trees were planted. But they didn't quite hit the mark when the trees were planted in the scenario I'm talking about, because they planted the wrong tree and they planted it right under the lines instead of planting it back maybe a little closer to the sidewalk, further from the curb. These trees not only are going to be in conflict with the power lines in the future, but with buses and big trucks. It's not just about planting trees. It's the right tree, right place, which we've talked about many times.
If you have any questions about landscaping or gardening, including anything about utility pruning, send them in and Patrick Murphy with ISU School of Biological Sciences will answer them. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can find this and other WGLT podcasts wherever you get your podcasts, or subscribe and find past episodes of Grow at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. It's made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. That's where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Brianna Groh, Mike McCurdy, Patrick Murphy, and our friends at IPR. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And if you are a podcast fan, we've got a bunch of new ones to subscribe to. We've spun off WGLT's McHistory, Center Stage, and the Next Normal Story Slam into their own feeds. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLTFM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. And I'm at Ryan WGLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.